So this is our third day of this very brief three-day retreat on the Buddhist path of altruistic living, or I am here for you. As I said earlier, this is a lifetime endeavor. This is a lifetime of aspiration and intention for not only the kind of person you want to be in life, but really, even more importantly, the kind of world we want to live in. Most people would say, yeah, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a world where people cared about one another, took care of one another, thought well of one another, did for others, right? And yet, the going about that seems to have eluded so many. And again, what you've learned over these 3 days is an altruistic world begins with me. An altruistic world is made up of altruistic people. It is not abstract. So when we understand that, it gives us a added sense of responsibility that I am not only responsible for myself, but I am responsible for others. I am responsible for this world, and in all my thoughts, and all my words, and all my actions, I am either contributing to creating that world of understanding, of loving kindness, of compassion, of connection and interconnection, or I'm not. And sometimes that not could be just by a neutral act of not acting in a certain way, but sometimes it actually is the opposite. Our judgments, our criticism, our egocentricity, our angers, our fears are actually contributing to the continuation of a world that where individuals are primarily concerned about themselves or their families or their religious group or their ethnic group or their state or their religion or their whatever. So this path that you've learned about today is an ancient path. And it postulates this really, as we've learned, this very wonderful idea that the path of altruism, the path of connection and interconnection, the path of loving kindness, the path of caring, and the path of empathy and compassion not only benefits others, but it benefits me. If I am mostly concerned about my own happiness, then going about it, following the path of egocentricity and self-centeredness, does not work. I will not be happy that way. But if I follow the path of selflessness, the path of kindness, of service, of love, compassion, I will be happy. I will feel connected. I won't feel so alone. I will feel warm. I will have a deep sense of well-being within. Love is therapeutic. It is healing. It heals, we hope, the persons or people that it is generated toward, But most importantly, it heals us. I know you spent a lot of time yesterday doing the alchemical exchange. That profound practice goes back, it is found in the great teachings, and I'll share some of that today, the great Buddhist master and teacher of the way of the Bodhisattva from the 8th century, Shantideva. But you know that in its current formulation, the way you've been practicing, it was brought to Tibet around the 10th century by the great Indian teacher Atisha, a noble Atisha who had 108 teachers. He was a master of the Dharma and meditation in all aspects. But he'd heard about this lineage of this alchemical exchange, and it had died out in India. And he had to go all the way to Indonesia, that time it was a Buddhist country, to find a master of this tradition. And he spent 3 years there, and then he brought it back with him to India, and then he brought it with Tibet. And he said, I had 108 teachers, but the one I always remember is Sirlingpa, his teacher that who taught him this exchange. Again, if one is also at the same time cultivating an introspective, meditative wisdom path that involves mindfulness, concentration, and insight, and combines that with this loving kindness, compassion, attitude practices, then one really has a very full and rich unfolding, and they feed each other. Many people wonder why, even with their insights into the nature of mind or thoughts or their understandings, they still feel encapsulated in the shell of self. It is because it is very possible, and the Buddha himself realizes, it is very possible to cultivate a path of mindfulness, a path of learning to relax the mind, learning to disengage from afflictive emotions, learning to cultivate so-called meditative trance states, and that can bring value, but one can still have a closed heart. Combining the two is the recommended method. We need to break out of this cocoon of self-centeredness. It manifests not just in big things, it manifests in little things. We come into the Dharma Hall, I've often seen this, right here. Come into the Dharma Hall, too cold. What do? They close the windows immediately. Somebody's too warm. They immediately, you know what I mean? It's like, who are we thinking about? There are 45 people here, and who are we thinking about? Whose comfort am I thinking about? Me. I don't think what's going on with everybody. I just want the temperature perfect for who? For me. And that's tiny. We don't realize that goes on all day. We're always controlling and manipulating life to get it to be the way I want, so I can be comfortable, so I can be safe, so I can be happy, so I can have the right place, the right situation. And we don't even realize that because it's so normal, because that's what everybody else is doing. And we don't realize that constant alertness for self and always concerned about the self is the very source of our sense of disconnection from others. In the Mahayana, what is positive is always the greater good. I may have my own needs and wants, but how does that relate to the greater good? And when there's a conflict,
What do you choose?
The greater good. It's like in relationships these days. You know, it is very hard for people because of the pervasive spreading of selfhood. And I think also because people get married later or come together in relationships later, so they've lived longer alone. And when you live alone, you are used to what? Living for me. And so people have a hard time in relationships creating what? A we. Right? That's a challenge, right? I know how to focus on me. This one knows how to focus on me. So let's create a relationship where we can compete with each other. Rather than what? Understanding there's a we that's bigger than a me. There's an us. And maybe caring more about the us, caring more about the we, is the path to a happy relationship. Could it be? And that goes on all day. We go into a meeting. We have what? Our opinions. Our ideas of what's right and how things should be. We are not open, are we? And we don't know why we're so tenacious, why we're so disturbed by how things go. And is it because we are focused just on what? What I think is best, what I think is right. So we don't listen to others. We don't see other people's perspective. Right? Earlier during this retreat, you did a meditation, hopefully, about learning to see things from another's perspective. That is also a profound practice. It is a practice that is based on non-separation. I am the other. Well, if I am the other, then, and it's not just a conceptual thing, if I am the other, then how does the world look to the other? How does this situation look to the other? Why would the other think this way, feel this way, react this way? When we do that, it changes things. When we think about the whole, when we make decisions, will this benefit the earth? Sounds a little grandiose, but yet it's true. Will this benefit future generations? Do I want to care for them? So altruism, there's a wonderful book out now by Matthew Ricard. People know Matthew Ricard. He's a French Buddhist. He's a Buddhist monk. And he basically spent much of his Buddhist career studying with great masters in Asia and practicing quite deeply. But in the last decade or so, I really historically don't know, he's kind of come back to the West, and he wrote an earlier book called Happiness that was very well received. He's quite popular now, so maybe you've all heard of him. He wrote a book called Happiness, but his most recent book is quite a book. It's called Altruism. It's almost 600 pages long. It probably has 1,000 footnotes. And basically, in every area of human endeavor, right, from psychology to economics to education to sociology to anthropology to zoology, he makes a case for altruism. I mean, it's really, if you're interested in this subject, it's called Altruism. it's quite a book. And it's all the research. It's just, but he basically says, the altruistic intention is the answer to the problems of this world. Until that is generated, the capacity of human beings to approach all the problems of the world with some kind of intelligence, with some sort of communal kind of responsibility, will never occur. So, that is why people like the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh have spent so much time in their endeavor, even though they have the capability of being great, quote-unquote, Buddhist teachers, spend so much time in a public arena talking about just, you know, very humanistic kind of things. Right? The Dalai Lama promotes a religion of loving kindness, right? Of compassion for everyone. This is common to all religions and all spiritual paths. And even non-religious path. So, thinking of the greater good. Not thinking of myself. How can I bring a benefit to people today? Going into work, being with other people. Am I thinking just of myself? My own desired outcome, or am I thinking of how can I help another human being? How can I cultivate compassion and loving kindness and understanding in all the situations of my day? This is how a bodhisattva practices. A bodhisattva is people like ourselves, but is somebody, a man or woman, who in their mind has cultivated this aspiration to, because one is deeply touched by the suffering of beings, including oneself, but notices that all motherly sentient beings, more or less, are suffering, deeply wants participate in the alleviation of the suffering of the world. That's big. And understands the only real way for me to learn how to do that is to alleviate and uproot the causes of my own suffering. This is the Buddhist view. It really is a very distinctive view from a political view. Political view says what? We legislate. But we see in the world of legislation, you know, what's legislated 1 year is unlegislated 10 years later. Why is that? Because the minds of human beings haven't changed. And Buddhism has always understood that it is the human mind that creates the world. It is the human beings getting together with a certain mind state that creates economic systems and social systems and political systems and educational systems and cultural systems, right? It's a feedback loop. But the change has to begin at a very basic level, and the basic unit of life are human beings. And the very basic unit of a human being is our minds. Right? And that is why in Buddhism, the transformation, the healing and transformation of the mind and all these practices, whether it's the practice of mindfulness, whether it's a practice of cultivating concentration, whether it's a practice of deep looking insight, whether it's a practice of generating loving kindness, altruism, equanimity, equality of view, all these things are about what? The mind. When the mind is changed, then it is much easier to change the speech and to change the actions. Because you're no longer struggling out here, you know, people are struggling out here to control their behaviors. Right? You know, to control what they eat. It's crazy. Why are people struggling with what they eat? Because they don't really care about their bodies. If you cared about your bodies, you would take care of it. Isn't that true? It's quite simple. If you cared about your body, you would take care of it. You care about your car? Everybody here have a car? You care about your car? Darlene cares about her car. Do you put junk, adulterated gasoline in your car? You would never do that. Would you? Never. And yet, You know, we'll pour the junk in here. Why is that? Because we don't care about ourselves in this deep way. We don't care about our, we don't act from a sense of this body is a gift to me. It was a gift from my parents. It is the vehicle in this life that allows me to do everything. Right? That's what it's here for. It's a vehicle. Right? And my job is simply to be the best caretaker of it. When that is in your mind, you will eat healthy and you will exercise, you'll get sleep, because you're taking care of it in the same way you take care of your car, same way you take care of your house. It's simple, right? It's not like every time Darlene goes to the gas station, she goes, well, should I look around and buy some crap to put in the gas tank? Right? You don't think like that, right? No. Right? But then we'll go into the convenience store and buy some crap for ourselves. I mean, do you see what I'm saying? This altruism, this sense of caring for the well-being of everyone, including ourselves, will answer so many of these struggles that you have in life. The things we consume with our minds. So much junk, so much poison that people consume. And don't think it doesn't affect us. It does affect us. And more deeply, we consume mind states. Right? Our mind, it feeds on fear, worry, anxiety, sadness, despair, jealousy, envy, anger, resentment, hurt, disappointment, right? We're consuming that stuff too. That's what's making up our mind. In the same way, what is it? You are what you eat. Isn't that what they used to say? You are what you eat. Remember that? You are what you eat. That somehow all the cells of our body is made up of the food we eat. That's what it's made up of. Right? This body is made up of the earth. And the food becomes our body. But all the things our mind is consuming becomes our mind in the same way. And when you understand that, you are very aware that when you consume a mind state, consume a conversation, you know, that this is feeding your mind and it will have a result. The mind you have, you know, people go, well, where did this mind come from? Or why does this mind feel this way? Why does this mind think this way? It's because we have been cultivating these mind states and these thoughts for decades. Remember, we started out with a very empty mind as children, as infants. It's all about consumption. That's why Thich Nhat Hanh says we need a diet. So this is our final day, and I did say this morning I would spend the time looking forward. There were some questions that people asked early on. I said, let's save it. You know, the how to apply. How do I know for certain what I believe to be an open heart is truly devoid of ego? What signals, signs, feelings help me know? Well, again, I think it's clear. When self is present at some level, and the more you are self-aware, the more you're mindful, the more you can experience that. But, you know, As long as there is an agenda, the motivation isn't pure. If your only thought is to benefit another without any outcome or result expected at any level, and it's just pure wanting to be of benefit, then we would say the motivation is pure. And how will you know whether your motivation is pure or not? Because you see, if you don't get the outcome you want, how are you going to feel? How are you going to feel when you don't get your, if your altruistic whatever it is that doesn't meet with the success you expected? How do you feel? No, you don't. Oh, if you don't need that. You're right. But let's say you haven't been conscious of you think you're doing an altruistic act. And then you get a result and you feel what? Disappointed, annoyed, sad, frustrated. What else? Angry, hurt, devastated. What do you know? My motivation wasn't pure. Yeah, simple. Okay. When you act purely, you feel pure. Is that clear? When you act purely, you will feel pure. Because it's about the action, it's not about the outcome. Right? Do you remember I said yesterday? In Zen, you know, I vow to liberate all sentient beings. That's big. But what does it mean day to day? Well, it means in all my actions, I do my best to be of benefit. But it's not attachment to any outcome. Because I can't control outcome. Can you control outcome? Can anybody here control outcome? Anybody ever try to control outcome? Yeah. Then what happens? If you get the outcome you want, you're what? Happy. Right. But unfortunately, you can't always get it, can you? Most of the time, you probably can't. And so when you can't get it, what do you feel? Angry, disappointed, you know, all the things we talked about. Okay. So if there is suffering involved with you, you know your motivation is impure. It's really that simple. You just do your best. You just put it out there. You make a selfless act. But whether it works, whether the person works, whether the world works, we don't know. Do we? Because there's so many variables at life. In Buddhism, nothing is fixed, nothing is solid. Everything is made up of parts, and all those parts are moving and unfolding according to causes and conditions, of which our aspiration and intention and our actions of body, speech, and mind are just one. We have to be humble. And we have to be wise. Would we like to reverse global warming? Everybody would like to reverse global warming? Yeah. Would we like to leave a sustainable world for our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren? Yeah. Do we know that our efforts and actions to reverse the global warming are going to succeed? Absolutely not. Isn't that true? But that doesn't mean we don't act. Right? We always act for the greater good. Those are bodhisattvas. That's just what they do. That's their job. That's our job. Right? Wherever we are, whether we're in the most intimate of relations, work, whatever arena our life falls, whatever arena of life we are active in, we are always working for the greater good. And that's it. Because that's what we can control. We can control to the best degree the actions of our body, speech, and mind. And that's what we're working on. So as we said on the first day, not only do we have a to-do list, we have a to-be list. So every day we have our to-do list, but every day we have our to-be list. How do I want to be today? Do I want to be mindful? Do I want to be present? Do I want to be understanding? Do I want to be open to the views of others? Do I want to be kind to everyone I meet? You see, this is what we're doing every day, really. This is what bodhisattvas are really doing. Outwardly, they may be working a job, right? But that's not what it's about. It's about this inward transformation. That's always occurring. There was another one here. What did I do? Would you please address boundaries, when and how to say no? Well, let me do the easy one. Okay? Can I ask whose question this is? Would you please address boundaries? Probably frightened people of my answers yesterday. No, it's all. I'll be kind. Would you please address boundaries, when and how to say no? Who asked this question? Somebody must have asked this question. Maybe this came from the lunchroom.
Question, but I have it.
All right. So the when and the how. So let's do the how first. Okay. Okay. Please say no. Okay. So you know how to say no. Okay. So that takes care of that half. See how easy it is? I mean, people go, how do you say no? I mean, you just say no. I mean, what's so hard about that? If it is hard for you, then you got to kind of go a little deep. Because you can say no, can't you? Right. So the issue is not that you don't know how to say no. What's the issue, let's say? I mean, the issue is different. You see, we express it like the problem is I can't say no. Well, of course you can say no. You can say no, you can say yes. We learned that, you know, like when we were 3 years old. Why don't we say no? Yeah, ego. It becomes about self. I don't, like Rob said, I don't want to disappoint the other person. Or I'm afraid of people's anger. Or I want people to like me. You know, all this ego. That's all self stuff, isn't it? Right? Isn't it? I mean, am I missing something?
No.
No. There you go. Well, that was great. You're cured.
Yeah. That's the first word I'm waiting for.
It was. Well, situations are fluid. Sometimes we say yes and sometimes we say no. Right? I mean, the main thing is, see, we're always looking for external rules. But the truth is, we have to know ourselves. Right? I mean, my yes and no may be different than your yes and no. Right? But again, you know, it's a complicated question a little bit. But again, from what we're talking about is, I say yes to something that will benefit someone. I say yes to goodness. I say yes to kindness, right? And I say no to selfishness, right? I say yes to things that will relieve people's suffering, and I say no to things that won't. So that's where you get into boundaries, right? To saying yes to, you know, somebody wants to abuse me, do I say yes? Or do I say no? Well, I mean, there's obviously a self-protective element, but obviously to say yes, is that benefiting the abuser? No. Just perpetuating their own delusions and their own anger and their own, right? And is it helping me and my suffering? No, it's only increasing that. So it's something to say no to. If an alcoholic tells you to pick up a bottle on a fifth on your way home, what do you say? You say no. Why? Why do you say no?
Say no because it increases their suffering.
Right. Yeah, it's not benefiting them. It's harming them. So here, you know, a yes is actually should be a no. I mean, is there more behind this question about boundaries in terms of what, I mean, boundaries is, I know, a whole issue for people, but yes.
Sometimes I wonder if we understand.
It doesn't seem to be on.
Can anybody hear me?
Yes.
Understand how to evaluate that. So someone yesterday mentioned, and I'm not, as you said, we don't need... guidelines, strict guidelines, but someone mentioned, someone begging for a beggar on the street, and whether to give something to them was good, or a yes or no, because you might not be helping them. So the question is, how do we know ourselves enough or know enough to evaluate what helps someone or not?
And what is your name?
Gus.
Yeah. So again, I would say these are questions to struggle with, to learn with, right? In the end, whether you give a beggar nothing, or if you give a beggar a dollar or $5, it probably will not make a significant difference in their life, will it? No. So it's really not about that, is it? It's about how do I help someone? Right? Some people think, if I give to people who are begging, I'm just perpetuating that, and there are all kinds of governmental, non-governmental institutions where people are taken care of, and that's where we should be sending them. And get them off the streets, right? And that's a very cogent argument, isn't it? Getting people to the services. On the other hand, there is a very human encounter with someone who is suffering, which is also true. I don't know, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. I don't know why. Whenever I see a beggar, someone comes up to me, I'm always deeply moved by them. I'm not afraid or I'm not disgusted. I'm deeply saddened by this sister or brother who has entered such an unfortunate path in life. So I always try to be kind, right? And if I'm telling them about a shelter a couple blocks away, I say it in a way that to let them know that I care about them. But on the other hand, if I give them money, and even if I know they're going to use it to buy drinks or drugs, I can still say something kind to them. I know you are suffering. I hope your life gets better. A lot of times I get in conversations with these guys or women and really say, there is another way. I don't preach. So it's interesting when talking about the Dalai Lama, when I was in, when I had that conversation many years ago with the Dalai Lama, and it was early in my trip into India, he actually said to me, this is interesting in terms of how to deal with it. He said, and again, in India, there aren't institutions. Begging is just widespread. And he said, in India, you'll meet many beggars. Many will come up to you. And he said, this is what you should do. He said, whether you give them 5 paisa, these are like pennies, or you give them 100, whatever you give them, he said, He said, the important thing is you look in their eyes and you say in your mind, at this moment, this is all I can do to help you. But my deepest aspiration is that one day I'll be a Buddha. And when I have that kind of understanding and energy, I will find you. And I will do my best to liberate you. So that's what he said to me. Liberate you. Free you from your suffering. So what he was saying was you use all opportunities to generate this mind of altruism. And again, in Buddhism, intention is very important, right? I mean, here, where, you know, it's interesting where we go, you know, like, what should I do? See, we're doers, aren't we? And in Buddhism, it's really about, it's not about, that it's not about doing. The Dalai Lama didn't say, don't give to them. He said, but the most important thing is your intention. You know, what are you doing with your mind? Are you using this as an opportunity to transform your mind? To keep moving it in that direction of cultivating that bodhicitta, that enlightened attitude. And using encounters with a beggar. I mean, I don't know if you got into it in your various meditations that you've done. And please understand, all the meditations that you were given, this is a transmission. These teachings were given to me by my teachers, some of them that held these transmissions, and these are ancient. These go back thousands of years. Human beings have used these practices to learn how to generate a sense of connection to others, a caring about others, an empathy for the suffering of others, and a genuine compassion to want to alleviate it. We cannot, and this is very central to the bodhisattva path and how we look at difficult people in difficult situations. We cannot develop loving kindness, compassion alone. We need others, don't we? So if you have a spiritual aspiration in this life for your own healing and transformation, please understand, you need other people, right? Who are you going to practice on? Is that clear? So even for purely selfish reasons, it's good to have other people in the world, right? Oh, I bow to you, Donald Trump. You are helping me in so many ways. That's not what you read about in the New York Times, is it? Or on Fox News. No, it's all about anger and agitation and fear, judgment. But it's not going, oh, the people who give me a hard time in this world, the difficult people, the difficult situations, they are helping me develop, grow, if I use them. So Shantideva, the great bodhisattva, says, you know, on your altar, half the altar should be for the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, and the other half of the altar should be for all the people who give you a hard time. Right? It was very interesting. I mean, this is 8th century, yeah. Half and half. The Buddhas teach and inspire, and the difficult people in difficult situations give us the practice. Without them, we could not develop. How do you develop patience unless there are people that you are highly impatient? I mean, how are you going to develop patience without traffic? That's what, so you think traffic's there just to get in my way. No, traffic is there to teach us patience. Traffic is there to teach us humility, that it's not all about me. That everybody else has a right to be on the road when I'm on the road. You know, in the world of ego, what? When I get on the road, they should all be off. Right, so I can very quickly get to where I want to go, right? And at the very least, if they drive on the road, they should drive just the way I want them to, right? See, that's egocentricity, and we don't even think. That's just me thinking about me. So all situations of difficulty are opportunities to cultivate this mind of altruism, this mind that gets out of itself, always thinking about itself. I mean, I do it myself, you know. I mean, I'm in Publix or I'm somewhere and there are all these lines and I look around to scan what? Which is the shortest, because I, you know, am so important, I got to get out of here quickly. I mean, where am I? I'm just going home. Right? And yet, can you see how crazy this self is? It doesn't matter where it is, it's always scanning for its own advantage. Right? I mean, it doesn't look around and say, maybe there are other people who may be in a hurry, you know what I mean? Maybe, right? You know, let me go on the longest line. Let somebody else get there, right? You ever think that way, Kelly?
Yeah.
Good, I like that. You know what I mean? Isn't that funny? We would go, what? Yeah, I'm not in a hurry. I'll just get on the long line. Let somebody else get there first. Right? And that goes on all day. Yeah, let them win the argument. Right? Yeah, let them feel good about winning this one. It's fine. What do I care? It's not about winning. It's about the we. If he or she's happy, it'll be nicer to be with. Right? Yeah. Give victory to others, it says in our tradition. Take defeat upon oneself. Un-American as it can be. Give victory to others. Take defeat upon oneself. It's a very different way. So, before we end, there were some questions in the beginning. I remember some questions about just, you know, going forward, how to do. All right, now we're at the end of our retreat. We'll all be going home in a few hours. You've all been practicing very diligently. You've been about cultivating this altruistic mind. I am here for you. Now you're all going home. All those people, they're still there. Okay, so now if you have any questions about how to handle this or that, now's the time, okay? All of you have been holding back. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're with somebody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're breathing in their black stuff. It's mixing with our black stuff. And it's dissolving. And then we're blowing out our white light to them, correct? Then I got confused last night because then we don't go back and look at their black stuff because it's dissolved, right?
Yeah, so this is an alchemical exchange. This is not an analysis. This is not working through. Okay? Please understand, this is not any of that. What are my issues? What are her issues? What are his issues? What, you know, this is not any of that. This is an immediate transformation of negativity. Immediate. Yeah, dissolves like that. It's called alchemical. Remember the alchemical. It means taking base metal and turning it into gold. We are taking two very key items. We're taking the afflictions of another human being, and we're taking our own self-centeredness. And we are immediately, by this practice, transforming them. How do we transform them? And again, you know, the visualization, which is a meditation, is about learning this process in our minds, okay? But it needs to be practiced. And often when we're out there practicing, what is it really about? Okay, don't get hung up on the visualization, which is a meditative, you know, it's using the imagination in this transformative way. What are we learning? We are learning how to be loving and compassionate human beings. Right? In the world with real people in real situations. That's what it's about. We are learning that immediately when we are in the presence of suffering, our own or someone else's, we do not wall off, right? We do not analyze. We do not strategize, right? Or any of the stuff we usually do. We immediately are present. We immediately are present to our own suffering and the suffering of others, and we immediately are open to it. That's the breathing in, right? We are open to it. We breathe it in. And by being open to another suffering, we immediately come out of our self-centered world. Can you see it? And not only that, because we don't just stop at empathy, we immediately generate compassion, which is, what do I need, or what does this person need that would remediate this suffering? Right? If they're scared, they need confidence, support. If they're angry, they need calming and understanding. You see what I'm saying? So you immediately generate from, it's called the exchange because you give of yourself. You see, you find those qualities in yourself that either you need or they need, and you give it to them. I don't need it. You take it. I give you all my happiness. I give you all my confidence. I give you all my fearlessness. I give you all my strength. But you also give that to yourself when you're suffering. And you do the exchange until you really feel that they are no longer suffering and you are now totally open. Right? That's the exchange. That's how you know you can stop. Now again, we are such students who want to get A's. You know, it's not about getting an A on visualization. Okay, is that clear? This is about becoming, you know, in the world, this kind of human being. That's what this is about, okay? So, you know, is that clear?
Get it, right?
Right. Yeah, they may not get it. I mean, if you believe that thoughts and things have their own energy and that it can affect other people, that's wonderful. Maybe it does. But that's really not the important thing. It's a transformative for me. It's changing my mind and my actions. That in the face of suffering, my own, the world, other people, you know, I don't have to get distressed. I don't have to wall off. I don't have to be indifferent. I don't have to analyze and fixate and all that stuff. I simply open. I breathe it in. Right? Most people go, phew. I mean, people would often say to me, ooh, I got enough suffering of my own. I don't want to breathe in anybody else's suffering. Phew. Toxic. Toxic stuff. Again, it's alchemical. Right? You're not breathing in the suffering and then kind of like, wallowing in it. That's when people often, that's what we talked about yesterday about, you know, empathic fatigue. It's like you take it in and you just wallow in it. No, it's not that. You take it in and you immediately transform it because you generate in your own mind all these positive things that you immediately give to that person, which makes you happy because you're doing something in your mind. You're not impotent. Now, obviously, you don't stop there. I mean, this is about the transformation of the mind to create the compassion and attitude that hopefully will generate action, if action is possible. Right? Is that clear? So this is transforming of the mind. As Shanti Davis said, there is bodhicitta of intention and bodhicitta of action. Of the two, the second is the best. Right. So if we say, well, I'm really, my metta and loving kindness and my Tonglen is just wonderful these days. I am just such a wonderful, compassionate, loving person at home on my cushion. But don't get me around real people. I mean, right. They're suffering. What a mess. You know, there are many people like that. You know, they practice these things in sort of a kind of a spiritual bubble. Okay? This is to be practiced, this is to be lived. And we do these practices so we can live it. Is that clear? Any other questions about the doing? You're going home, colleagues, family, situations. I mean, again, maybe the questions that people had the first day you don't have anymore because they've probably just by doing the practice, you understand. And you're aware already how these will benefit. Yes.
Could you give an example of how we might incorporate these practices into a formal practice?
Well, again, hopefully that's what went on. Right? Okay. So it's as simple as that, right? I mean, didn't you learn the formal practices?
Yes.
Right. So traditionally, again, you are... You know, there's sort of three kinds of practices, right? One is that the equalization, right? So you're no longer liking, you're open to the whole world, putting yourself in other people's shoes, feeling the connectedness, all that. That's one whole body of, two or three meditations that help us kind of get the ground. That's the basis. The second is the empathy, putting yourself in other people's shoes, being open to other people's suffering and stuff like that. Learning to have, again, metta is called loving kindness. It's often called friendliness. It means that, anybody here have a best friend or somebody they like or love? Okay. I mean, do you have to work at being kind to them? Do you have to work at wanting to them be happy? Do you have to work at, when they're suffering, I really got to care about this person. They're my best friend, so I should really care about their suffering. No, it's natural, right? So it takes what is natural and says you can extend it to everyone. It's only as you've learned because of conditions causing conditions, that this one, because they're supposed they're my family, I love them. These people, they're not my family, I don't love them. What if you were adopted at birth and all of a sudden you find out you have a whole birth family? Now I'll love them. You see, it's a choice. And bodhisattvas make the choice to love everyone. Okay? So then the final one is the Tonglen, which is we've equalized, we've sensed connection, right? We are understanding of everybody, we generate friendship toward all beings, and when they are suffering, we practice the Tonglen. We are present and we act. So again, it's a process of transformation, and depending on where we're at, we work it. Yes.
In case some of us have a little problem remembering, were the instructions for the practices recorded and possibly on the website?
I have no idea. So the question is, were they recorded? Now, again, please understand, there is nothing that has been taught to you that you cannot find in books and on the web. I mean, that's what I'm trying to say. These are not our practices. So... they can easily be found, maybe not exactly the way we did them here, but again, what you've received is a traditional transmission of these ancient practices. So again, I don't know about the answer to your question. The answer to your question is?
Well, I think we may have recorded some last night, but we are planning on creating a little blueprint of what we did and summarizing all the practices with just a few brief descriptions, and if we find helpful links to provide that, so a few days after.
And it's very interesting. Again, remember I said I kind of access the research and stuff like that. They're using these protocols as protocols in their research. So, I mean, a lot of these meditations are actually now being used in these various institutes or psychology departments or whatever as they do research on this. So they do a nice job. Yes?
I was one of the ones that had a question for you. Mm-hmm. I said, if I give and give and give, then all of a sudden I find that I'm empty. How do I replenish me? And I just want to clarify, I think there are two answers. One is that I find other people to give to that are really ready or that really want me to help them. And two, to check out my ego, because maybe I give and give and give because I'm really trying to get something from my ego back and forth. So it's one thing to find other people, but also to check my ego. Why am I doing this? Is that, did I get it correct?
Yeah, again, usually, like you say, the fatigue is because we're expecting a result and we're not getting a result and we get tired. Because we're really, it's not really tired, it's just, you know, disappointed, frustrated, and all that. And that's really, again, it's these type of afflictive emotions that are really robbing us. Again, as you've heard, you know, we want our motivation to help to be pure. And it has no sense. And that will not be fatiguing. That will actually be energizing. Love, compassion, is an energy. It's an energy. The same way being walled off, being constricted, being angry, resentful, hurt, anxious has an energy. Right? And one is very, you know, it's like, what do you want to be energized by? Right? I mean, many people are energized by what?
Anger.
Anger. Many people are energized by wanting to win. Right? That's what energizes. Win. Get there first. Be the best. You know, that's so, you know, there's lots of different energies. And you know, a lot of people are energized by anger. A lot of people energized by fear. They're always, ooh, that's the energy that motivates them. Stay safe. All costs. Right? So there's all, I mean, human beings have all kinds of energies. But many of these energies that, that motivate human beings are not very beneficial. Right? They are tightening. And they are exhausting. Love and compassion are not those kinds of energies. They are inexhaustible because they are the energy of our true mind. Our true mind has no barriers. Our true mind embraces everything. Our true mind, there's no self. So there's no walls at all. So it's an endless, it's like a, you know, it's like a spring. You know, like a spring that just always flows. Don't have to worry. Yes.
This morning, the profound guided meditation, the person talked about what if we found out we went upstairs, our Brian said the, our wallet was gone, but then he said, and you leave and you see one of our members here crash into our car and take off. And it was so profound because my in my past life I would have immediately thought Judge Judy, but in the but in view of these trainings, it's compassion with wisdom. I mean, to try to call the police is not going against what we've learned here. It's to live within the law and have compassion with wisdom, isn't it?
Yeah, again, this is not about this is about the way, this is about the mind. Right? It doesn't mean you know, that wrongdoers aren't caught. Right? But it means we don't do it out of hatred and we don't punish for the sake of punishment. We want to help them. Right? So it's a very different motivation. It's an understanding that, yeah, people bang into, you know, we've probably done it ourselves. But this person, for whatever reason, ran. We don't know why they ran. They ran because they're totally irresponsible and self-centered. They ran because they have a suspended driver's license and they don't want to get caught. You know what I mean? They ran because they're an illegal immigrant. You know what I mean? Who knows why they ran? Right? Because we don't know. We don't necessarily go to judgment. But yet there's a situation that needs to be taken care of, like you said. And how do we take care of the situation without all this affliction, all this anger and judgment and, you know. Again, it's like, you know, sometimes you have to act in a direct way, but you can feel regret, right? I mean, I have a home. Sometimes the little things that run around in there, you just have to get rid of. But whenever that decision is forced, I feel bad about it. I bow to that life that I am taking. Right? Now, again, I also understand from the point of view of that life, it's like, you know, who's he kidding? And I can understand that. I mean, I'm, you know. But I also understand, at least for me, I even when I have to act in that way, I do it with regret. This is a messy world. If we want to stay pure, we stay home. But if we enter this world, it's a mess, and we'll get our hands dirty. We can't be so pure when we enter the world. So I just want to share with you, and I'll just read some little things. You can just listen, like poetry. This is from Shantideva, this wonderful 8th century. It's called The Way of the Bodhisattva. It is the classic of the Buddhist path, of the Bodhisattva. And even though it has all the paramitas of wisdom and patience and meditation and mindfulness and vigilance, at the heart of the whole thing is this bodhicitta. Just relax. And I'm just kind of skipping around. If with kindly generosity one merely has the wish to soothe the aching heads of other beings, such merit knows no bounds. No need to speak then of the wish to drive away the endless pain of each and every living being, bringing them unbounded virtues. Could our fathers or our mothers ever have such a generous wish? Do the very gods harbor such benevolence as this? For in the past they never, even in their dreams, conceived such profit even for themselves. How could they have such aims for others' sake? For beings do not wish their own true good, so how could they intend such good for others' sake? This state of mind, so precious and so rare, arises truly wondrous, never seen before. The pain-dispelling draught, the cause of joy for those who wander through the world, this precious attitude, this jewel of mine, how shall it be gauged or quantified? For if the simple thought to be of help to others exceeds in worth the worship of the Buddhas, what need is there to speak of actual deeds that bring about the weal and benefit of others? For beings long to free themselves from misery, but misery itself they follow and pursue. These are very famous lines. They long for joy, but in their ignorance destroy it, as they would a hated enemy. But those who fill with bliss all beings destitute of joy, who cut all pain and suffering away from those weighed down with misery, who drive away the darkness of their ignorance, what virtue could be matched to theirs, what friend could be compared to them, what merit is there similar to this? For they who do some good in thanks for favors once received are praised. Why need we speak of bodhisattvas, those who freely benefit the world? Those who, scornfully with condescension, give just once a single meal to others, feeding them for only half a day, are honored by the world as virtuous. What need is there to speak of those who constantly bestow on boundless multitudes the peerless joy of blissful Buddhahood, the ultimate fulfillment of their hopes? And this is Shantideva talking about some of the things that we've done over these days. Strive at first to meditate upon the sameness of yourself and others. In joy and sorrow, all are equal. Thus be the guardian of all, as of yourself. The hand and other limbs are many and distinct, but all are one, one body to be kept and guarded. Likewise, different beings in their joys and sorrows are, like me, all one and wanting happiness. My pain does not, in fact, afflict or cause discomfort to another's body. Through clinging to my I, this suffering is mine, and being mine is very hard to bear. And others' beings' pains I do not feel, and yet because I take them for my very own, their suffering is likewise hard to bear. And therefore I'll dispel the pain of others, for it is simply pain just like my own, and others I will aid and benefit, for they are living beings just like me. Since I and other beings in wanting happiness are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us, that I should strive to have my bliss alone? Since I and other beings both in fleeing suffering are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us, that I should save myself and not the other? In this, in a likewise way, hands and other limbs are thought of as members of a body. Should we not consider others likewise, limbs and members of a living whole? Just as this form devoid of I, just as in this form devoid of I, the thought of self arose through long habituation, why upon the aggregate of living beings should not the thought of I through habit be imputed? Thus, when I work for others' sake, no reason can there be for boasting or amazement, for it is just as when I feed myself, I don't expect to be rewarded. Just as I defend myself, therefore, from all unpleasant happenings, however small, likewise I shall act for others' sake to guard and protect them with compassion. Those desiring speedily to be a refuge for themselves and other beings should interchange the terms of I and other, and thus embrace a sacred mystery. And finally, and these again very famous lines, all the joy the world contains has come through wishing happiness for others. All the misery the world contains has come through wanting pleasure for oneself. Is there need for lengthy explanation? Childish beings look out for themselves, while Buddhas labor for the good of others. See the difference that divides them. If I do not give away my happiness for others' pain, enlightenment will never be attained, and even in some sorrow, joy will fly from me. All the harm with which this world is rife, all fear and suffering that there is, clinging to the I has caused it. What am I to do with this great demon? If this I is not relinquished wholly, sorrow likewise cannot be avoided. For if he does not keep away from fire, a man cannot escape from being burned. To free myself from harm and others from their sufferings, let me give myself away and cherish others as I love myself. So that is a little bit of the poetry from this great teacher of the 8th century, Shantideva, The Way of the Bodhisattva. Good. So hopefully these last 3 days went by quickly. Hopefully we have a clear vision of a new path for our life, or if this is a path we've always been walking, a new understanding of what it's about, and a new rededication to following it. And for those who are new, perhaps it's got you thinking. Again, the most important thing is not just these talks, but really your own practice, You have been given, you know, the 6 or 8 fundamental meditations of this path of altruism. Please practice them. If you practice them, you will get results. It's just really as simple as that. You will feel differently. Your heart will feel differently. You'll relate to others differently. You will be more at ease in the world. You will feel more connected to others. And you will not be overwhelmed or overly distressed by your own suffering and pain and the suffering of others, because you will know through these practices how to deal with them, how to transform them. Is that clear? That's the alchemical exchange. So good. I bow to everyone.